First today, pain, and specifically the politics of pain. That's right, there's been a long-standing and pitched battle in this country over how chronic pain sufferers are regarded. Do they deserve compensation, or are these people taking advantage of what some see as a far too compassionate system? One big political hot potato, who gets to decide whether someone is truly in pain? With us today is Dr. Keith Wailoo. He's author of Pain, A Political History. He's the Vice Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. He's also the keynote speaker at this year's Center for Practical Bioethics Symposium. More on that in just a few minutes. Dr. Wailoo, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, people don't think of pain as being political, Keith, but it has become exactly that. How do many Democrats view that, and how do Republicans regard it?
Yeah, well, it's hard to overgeneralize, but sure. I'd say that over the history of the debate about people in pain, there has been a pitched tension between what you might call liberal compassion versus conservative grin-and-bear-it philosophy as it's applied to people in chronic pain. That's evolved dramatically over the last 70 years or so. And I, for one, was surprised when I started this project to see precisely how controversial the question of whether people in chronic yes. pain should be treated, how aggressively with medication, how compassionate should the disability system be towards their concern, or to what extent, you know, being tough on them, getting them back to work, treating them as more or less welfare cases rather than people deserving of long-term relief, how politicized this question has been over the course of the last 70 years, whether the question is disability or drug policy.
So which side is winning right now, Keith? Is it the compassionate side or the get tough side?
I think I would say that there have been, insofar as there's cycles in American history with regard to any political question, I'd say we're moving towards a liberal reform era. At the same time, they coexist with anxieties about over-medication as a problem in American society. So in some ways, I would say that while you might see trends in one direction or the other, that the interesting thing about history is that the tensions between a liberal perspective and a conservative approach to people in chronic pain kind of define every era. And so the differences are differences of small shifts in one direction over another with regard to very particular questions like OxyContin or pain medicine at the end of life or disability.
Well, you begin the story, speaking of history, with the challenge of caring for veterans in the wake of World War II. You begin your story there. Why?
Well, it's not the case that pain is new after World War II. Far from it. I mean, pain has always been a central and in some ways a really perplexing problem for clinicians as well as for society. But after World War II, it emerges in a particular way when you have soldiers returning from the front, many of them with devastating war wounds, in a society that in the wake of the New Deal era has grown its services for veterans. And one of the fundamental questions in the post-World War II era, you know, if people remember the Harry Truman era, was about the first wave of interest in national health insurance. And so you might say that it's these particular questions. What does government owe to its citizens? What does a government owe to particularly to returning soldiers? And the face of soldiers who are clearly crippled and in pain that brings to the surface the question of pain as not just an issue among soldiers, but then after World War II, you also have the realization that America is an aging society. It's much more of a sedentary society than it had been in the past. And so chronic pain, because of these demographic shifts, because of the war, and because of sensitivities to how illness is changing, gradually rises into the surface, into becoming part of both a medical discussion and a social and a policy discussion.
Well, as you go from Truman into Eisenhower then, Doctor, it was interesting to me. You point out that President Eisenhower, who obviously commanded Allied forces in World War II, was determined not to allow mere sympathy to drive government expansion. So when it came to the 1956 law creating Social Security disability insurance, he signed it, but he was a little ambivalent about it. Why?
So that's a really crucial part of this story. He was ambivalent about it because he was pushed on one side by the American Medical Association and doctors who had warred against Harry Truman's proposal, which they call socialized medicine, had warred against, in fact, the expansion of the Veterans Administration as a way that they really felt, the doctors felt, that ultimately these soldiers belonged in the private healthcare system. So on the one hand, you might say on the political right, Harry Truman as a general, he was not an ideological Republican, but he's a Republican that comes out of the military.
Dwight Eisenhower you're talking about now.
Dwight Eisenhower, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But on the one hand, he has the right on that side. But at the same time, he's concerned about what does a society owe to its veterans. At the same time that this debate is unfolding, a very skillful legislator in the Senate named Lyndon Baines Johnson, who's the Senate Majority Leader, leading into the 1956 elections, aided by other senators like John F. Kennedy from Massachusetts, decide to put on the docket the consideration for establishing a disability benefit within Social Security, really fundamentally transforming Social Security from just a federal program for people who are elderly to those who are also disabled. And it turns out that in that context, it proves very difficult for Eisenhower to veto this legislation. He's in a re-election campaign. He himself, by the way, is disabled at that moment, having suffered a heart attack, where he's assuring the public that he's fine. And there are discussions about whether he as a president is disabled and fully able to carry out his duties. And, you know, the vagaries of an election mean that he has to make a very tough decision. And so he reluctantly signs that piece of legislation where the AMA sees him as a traitor to the cause. They see this as putting physicians in an untenable position, and that is judging when somebody is truly disabled. So it takes this issue of pain that is just emerging into public awareness, in the medical awareness, and it thrusts it into the center of a debate about government, about who should judge whether someone in chronic pain is truly disabled and what degree of benefits they deserve. And so that's where my story starts. It's this convergence of so much in post-war society that really brings this question of pain, not as a medical question, but almost fundamentally from the outset as a political question.
Yeah, yeah. Let's move ahead to the 1960s. The debate changes a little bit again. There was more concern in those years, not just about mortality, but about, you know, chronic degenerative ailments. The workforce is expanding. What did the courts begin saying back then, Keith, about what the standard was for, you know, real pain?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I mean, as I said, you know, there's so much in this book that I found surprising in the writing, and one of them is the role of the courts in not physicians and not politicians, but judges. And what when there's a set of crucial cases, because after all, now you've created this disability system and people are applying for benefits from health, education, and welfare. Many of them are rejected and they seek legal recourse in the courts. And so it's the courts that ultimately by the early 1960s have to judge when is pain real pain and when is it not real and compensable. And there's a particular case of a Texas housewife named Rosie Page who applies for disability benefits, is rejected, and her case really moves through the courts. And there's a crucial case of ruling that's made in 1963 by a Republican appointee appointed by Dwight Eisenhower, Judge John Brown, who essentially issues a statement that becomes a major reference point through the 1960s. He says, if pain is real to the patient, given the fact that subjective pain is so difficult to judge, it's hard to actually determine from the outside whether the extent of an individual's pain. Pain, unlike any other thing, is it's not like a blood pressure where you can objectively determine mm-hmm. what blood pressure is. It's not like temperature. And so you might say that his judgment, if pain is real to patient, then HHS or HEW at the time needs to treat it as real and needs to provide those forms of relief that they would for any other form of disability. And you might say that this is the court not just commanding the government, but also articulating a liberal view of what government owes to people who are vulnerable or who are in pain. In many ways, it speaks to the cultural and political trends of the 1960s. Shortly thereafter, you have the passage of Medicare, the question of the elderly, people with arthritis, and what kind of support a compassionate society should provide for them.
And this you call this the bureaucracy of pain, Medicare, Medicaid, interesting terminology.
Well, you know, I don't, you know, people usually kind of like to malign bureaucracy. But one of the things that I think emerges by the 1960s is the idea that we need experts, we need gatekeepers, we need bureaucrats, we need people at the reins of government who are in a position to judge these questions about worth, about the truthfulness of somebody's concern, and about what people deserve in terms of relief. So you might say that, yeah, the question of who's in pain and not and who is not becomes part of a broader machinery that government is creating in the 1960s. And in a result, you know, trying to this is why doctors ended up feeling really frustrated, because they were well aware that pain is so difficult to judge. It varies so dramatically by individual to individual. And so this is part of the rise, you might say, of pain as a legitimate problem that needs compassionate relief.
That's
and
so
how the story of pain is connected to the liberal impulses of the 1960s.
Dr. Keith Whalew is the author of Pain, A Political History. He'll be speaking at the annual dinner of the Center for Practical Bioethics. That will be a week from tonight. That's April 30th at the Marriott Muehlbach Hotel downtown. More information, go to practicalbioethics.org. I'll put that web address out again in just a little bit. If you want to join our conversation as we talk about pain and specifically the politics of pain, 816-235-2888 is our number here. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, again, let's fast forward one more time, Keith, and talk about sort of the rise of the right and how President Ronald Reagan began to view all this, because he changes the discussion and changes it dramatically. How so?
So he changes it in the early 1980s when he comes into office. He's elected in 1980. He comes into office in January of 1981. And, of course, the hallmark of his inauguration is when he says government is not the solution to our problems. In these present times, government is the problem.
Yeah.
And in some ways, his assault on liberalism generally was also an assault on the social welfare state, the welfare state, as he argued, that had created, in the name of helping people, dependence. In other words, people had become – they'd been drawn out of this vibrant private market into a public sector that had created a form of dependence and welfare. And he was an arch critic of this. Now, he had always been a critic of this. So even before the creation of welfare, he'd argued that the creation of Medicare, he'd argued that Medicare was the beginning of the end of fundamental American freedom. So in some ways, he'd always been articulating this, and the right had been sort of arguing this from this script through the 1960s into the 1970s. But now he's in the Oval Office. And he set in motion a process that Carter himself, who was he was a conservative Democrat, and he himself had begun to rethink the expansiveness of this disability system. But what Reagan does in 1981 is he commands his Secretary for Health and Human Services, it became Health and Human Services during this time, to rethink the disability program and particularly to review those who had subjective reasons for their disability. Hmm. And over the course of the next 3 years, almost 500,000 people were systematically removed from the disability rolls, many of whom were claiming pain as the source of their disability, and that pain had been validated in an old system. And so what Reagan pushed was the idea that unless you have objective criteria supported by anatomical evidence or medical testimony for what your disability is, it should be regarded as illegitimate. And so you can see how the problem of pain was front and center in the argument for, the title of the chapter is The Conservative Case Against Learned Helplessness. Mm-hmm. The idea that people in pain, and this is actually a question that pain managers today, people who treat people in pain, are grappling with at the micro level, which is it better to get out of the bed and get out and, you know, push on through the pain? Or is it, you know, do we need a society that's more compassionate towards those who are unable to live the way the rest of us live without pain? So you might say pain becomes a touchstone in the conservative argument against liberal excess.
So pain becomes symptomatic in a sense of a weak society, Keith?
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. this is an argument that so Reagan's arguments aren't new. Like I said, in the 1950s, the physician's argument against that disability benefit was, you know, when polled about whether pain should be a compensable disability, it was surprising to me how many of them in the 50s said, this is just liberalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't say pain, we need to treat it in a particular way. We need to be careful about how we measure it. They say this is an example of a coddling, an over-compassionate society that we know feeds dependency. Psychiatrists in the 50s, like some of the people I write about in the book, were fundamentally suspicious about whether complaints of pain were real or whether they were evidence of kind of psychological maladjustment. So Reagan, you know, he's a product of this era. He is a product of the 1960s, and he is, by the time he gets into the Oval Office, in a position to actually create social policy with this vision at its core. Now, the irony of this is that this only thrusts the courts even deeper into the question of the adjudication of pain, because after all, if you remove nearly 500,000 people from the disability rolls, you're going to get, as Reagan did, one, the accusation that conservatism was fundamentally heartless and not lacked compassion, but you're also going to get class action lawsuits in which these questions about deservedness make their way through the federal courts. And that's exactly what happened. So in the by the 84 and 85, you have the courts once again trying to figure out and weighing in on what is pain, who is deserving and who is not.
We're talking about the politics of pain with Dr. Keith Wailoo. He's the vice dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs out at Princeton. You know, something counterintuitive happens here. Reagan cracks down on this idea of pain and how it should be handled. And as part of the GOP's approach to government, deregulation was in vogue, and that allows the pharmaceutical industry to explode in size and arguably make many, many Americans more dependent on pain relief medication. What was the impact of that deregulation? Walk with me there a little bit.
Yeah, so your question really highlights that the issue of dependence cuts two different ways. There's the question of federal government dependence, which is what Reagan's target is. But, you know, Reagan, it's not necessarily ironic because a champion of the market as the solution to our problems and not government, he is someone who embraces market solutions. And so one of the hallmarks of the Reagan era is the deregulation, the idea that the Food and Drug Administration, instead of standing in the way of drug approval, we need to kind of unleash the power of the marketplace. So Food and Drug Administration policy shifts by the end of the Reagan administration and really into the Clinton administration. You have things like the rise of things we're familiar with today, like direct-to-consumer drug advertising. Like, you know, let people hear about the drugs and have them decide what drugs are necessary. And what deregulation does is it actually helps to fill a new market of pain relief drugs. And so if you actually track the rise, as I do in the book, of pain relief drugs from the 1980s to the present, it's really stunning. And I argue that it's a fundamental reaction to the deregulation of the drug industry, deregulation more generally, and the way in which the pharmaceutical industry has really capitalized on the Reagan Revolution and the argument that the marketplace is the solution to our problems. So by 1994, with this new system fully in swing, prescription drug abuse becomes the leading form of drug abuse in our country. Mm. So not marijuana, not heroin as it was in the 1970s, not LSD as it was, not it wasn't the leading in the 1960s, but the drug problems, you know, change as a result of these sorts of political and regulatory trends.
Let me throw out a couple of numbers here from the book, Keith. In 2009, 257 million painkiller prescriptions were dispensed in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that 12 million Americans abuse prescription painkillers. We see the rise of OxyContin. You've already mentioned that. So today, just how broad is the definition of chronic pain?
Oh, what a great question. Because chronic pain is so difficult to address, we often think about it as relating to very particular disorders, so arthritis pain, end-of-life cancer pain, which is not necessarily chronic, but it's certainly situational, and it can go on mm-hmm. for some time. And then you have a wide range of what you might call pains like chronic fatigue syndrome or mm-hmm. fibromyalgia or migraine. Pain in short, and then of course there's the extraordinarily important low back pain problem. Mm-hmm. And so pain comes in so many varieties that you might say each of them it becomes the focal point of different kinds of controversies. In a previous book I've written on sickle cell disease, and this is actually what got me interested in the problem of pain. Sickle cell disease is common among – it's more prevalent in African Americans. Mm-hmm. So it's seen as a disease that's characterized by recurring pains for people with this particular disorder who often in particular settings might arrive at the emergency room in crisis seeking certain kinds of pain medications. The question confronting many in the ER, nurses and doctors is this pain real or is this drug-seeking behavior? So you might say every pain – every kind of pain lends itself to a certain kind of skepticism and compassion, which is a reflection of this broader political question, these broader political questions about identity and what a society owes to people who are in need.
Well, this is so interesting, Keith. You took a topic I wasn't sure about coming in. You made it very interesting. I should point out that Dr. Keith Wailu speaks at the annual dinner of the Center for Practical Bioethics. That'll be a week from tonight in downtown Kansas City. More information, practicalbioethics.org. Keith Wailu's new book, Pain, A Political History. Thanks so much for a great conversation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Steve.